to the What's Cooking podcast with me, Kat, and my co-host, Beth. We talk to food entrepreneurs about their businesses, about how they got started, the journey so far, and what gets them out of bed in the morning.
Today, we're joined by Margie, presenter of Desert Island Dishes, chef and food writer. Hi, Margie.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. At your
house. It feels scary to be being interviewed for once.
Yeah, turning the tables. Okay, so could you start by telling us about your first ever job?
My first ever job. So I think I went through all the classics as a teenager of sort of waitressing, and I did my fair share of nannying. I spent pretty much every summer holiday of university doing various internships at law firms and really exciting asset management companies. But I think my first proper job was a cooking job. So after university, I did a master's in law, which you wouldn't do if you didn't want to be a lawyer. But so I thought that's what I really wanted to do. And whilst I was doing that, it just became obvious that I wanted to do something in food and that law probably wasn't for me. So I went to Ballymaloe, which is this amazing cookery school in Ireland. And it's 3 months long and it's amazing. But the whole time you're there, they are very conscious to say, you know, it's 12 weeks and we're going to teach you as much as you can. But cooking is all about experience. So you could very well leave there, not cook for 6 months, and I don't know how good you'd be at cooking. So it's definitely a building block that you build on. So that the whole time you're there, they're saying to you, you've got to think about what you're going to do next and whether you want to go and work in a restaurant. It would be a good next step, even if you don't end up doing that ultimately. And I kind of knew that I didn't want to end up in a restaurant, but I knew what they were saying was right. So I knew that it would be good for me. Anyway, so we got to the end of the course and I obviously hadn't made a plan. And my dad went to a really random dinner party and was kind of telling the person sitting next to him what I'd been up to. And they said, oh, well, that's really strange because we're setting up a hotel in South Africa. We need a chef to come out and to teach the women out there how to cook and to basically set up the kitchen. So my dad told me, and I mean, I didn't know if I was up to doing that. I'd just done a 12-week cooking course. I'd never run a professional kitchen, but I think that was probably my first proper job. So a week after my dad went to that dinner party, I was actually in South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal. So it's a really remote part of South Africa, made famous by, it's where the Zulu Wars happened. So it's a really interesting area because it's really remote, but then it's also this huge tourist destination because of the history. And there aren't any hotels out there. They're just these sort of beautiful lodges. And I don't know how good an idea it is to put a hotel somewhere like that. But anyway, I was out there for, I think it was 3 months, setting up the kitchen in the hotel, like cooking for paying clients and teaching these amazing Zulu women how to cook, you know, beef bourguignon and basically all the stuff that I'd been learning at Ballymaloe, which is what they told me that they wanted me to do. But it was really interesting because, you know, in a hotel kitchen, you obviously want to be able to serve really basic things like any kind of sandwich. And that just isn't what they eat out there. So half of it was just I guess with cooking, so much of it is about eating different food and kind of training your taste buds. I mean, that I am a very greedy person, but I think that is also not just an excuse for gluttony. I think it is true that to be a really good cook, you do have to experience as many different tastes as you can, and it's kind of like a constant learning process. So that was really interesting with these women, sort of teaching them what things should taste like and then how to actually make them. And sort of everything's so different. So out there, they love slow cooking meat and they love meat that you can sort of really chew. Like if it's got some gristle in it, or it's just a really different thing. Whereas out there, fillet of beef is really, really cheap because no one wants to eat it. And it's just all of those things were really different. And it was, I guess, kind of a once in a lifetime experience. But I think that was my first proper cooking job.
and thrown just straight into... Yeah, I can imagine just being on the plane, having done the 12-week cookery course, where, you know, I'm sure you were quite guided through everything, to suddenly feeling like you're now responsible for this kitchen. Must have been so scary.
It was so scary. And I'd never been to South Africa before. I don't think... I think when I hear stories like that, I always think, oh, that person's so brave. And I don't think I am a very brave person. So it did, it definitely wasn't something that I took in my stride. Like, I think I cried a lot in the week before I went, like, mommy, don't make me go. But I think I knew that it was going to be so good for me in so many different ways. And yeah, it definitely was. So.
Yeah. Amazing experience.
Yes, completely.
Did you look for another job in a restaurant when you got back to London?
So when I like tell this story, I know how it sounds and it sounds a bit ridiculous, but basically when I was trying to be a lawyer, which I did the master's in law, like I did think that that's what I wanted to do. So I did try quite hard to become a lawyer, and just like a series of events that happened, I don't know, it was so bizarre, just lots of really bad luck, and maybe I wasn't good enough, that was sort of the crux of it, but things did keep happening that you kind of just couldn't believe they happened, and when I, you know, could have possibly got a yes, I just was constantly getting no's. And then when I decided to be a chef, I kind of started immediately, because I decided that's what I wanted to do. And I you don't need a cooking qualification, but I just felt like that was the right thing for me. And I'd heard so much about Ballymaloe. So I decided that I wanted to go to Ballymaloe, and the course had already started. So I rang them and I said, oh, do you think there's any way that I could just come along? And they said, no. And the course has already been going for 2 weeks. So you've missed the start of it. And even if someone was to drop out, we've got, you know, a huge waiting list. So you should just try again in a year. But I didn't want to wait a year. I knew what I wanted to do. And so that was really hard to hear. But literally 35 minutes after I made that call, they rang back and they said, this is really bizarre and this literally never happens, but 5 minutes after we hung up the phone to you, someone's dropped out. So if you can get on a plane and come tomorrow afternoon, the place is yours.
Oh my God. Yeah,
like, when does that ever happen? And it's, honestly, I'm not the kind of person that would happen to. So I did. And so that was, I feel like that was kind of the beginning of my braveness, because I'm not the kind of person that would just sort of leave everything and go somewhere on a whim, but I did, and it worked out so well. And then that thing happened with my dad and the dinner party in South Africa. So then it was kind of fun, because I think at that point I was just going with the flow and just trying to say yes to everything and just get as much cooking experience as I could. So when I got back from South Africa, I knew then that I needed to work in a restaurant. I guess I tried to delay it, but I knew that I didn't want to do it, but I knew that it was going to be really good for me. And so there's a really nice restaurant quite near to where my mum lives. And when I landed back, she said, oh, I walked past, it's called Clark's and it's run by Sally Clark. And she said, I walked past and they have a sign in the window saying that they're looking for chefs. I think you should just go in this afternoon with your CV and just, you've got nothing to lose. So I did, I like printed off my CV, I went back straight from the airport and dropped in my CV. And then they rang that afternoon and they were like, can you come in tomorrow morning for an interview? So, yes. So I went for the interview and they were obviously really desperate, because she said, if you can go home and come back in with your whites, then basically you can start this afternoon. And so I did. And like that evening I was doing supper service, which was kind of unbelievable. But again, that was so good, because I was completely thrown in the deep end. I think, I can't remember the specifics, but they obviously were quite short-staffed, and it meant that I got way more responsibility than I kind of deserved at that point. And yeah, that was just like another amazing learning experience, but really, really stressful. I found working in a restaurant really hard.
How long did you work there for?
I think it was just over a year. But yeah, it was really difficult. It's It was, I guess, a combination of things. Like, the hours are really, really long. You're on your feet all the time, so it's physically really demanding. Sometimes I would go home having worked an 11-hour shift. And I'd get home and, yeah, I'd realise that I literally hadn't sat down all day. I'm definitely not afraid of hard work, but it was just physically really tiring. And also, it's just a stress like I've never experienced, which is really strange because I wasn't a lawyer, but I definitely spent a lot of time in law firms and doing quite stressful things. And you know, I went to quite academic university. And so, yeah, I feel like I dealt with stress, but a kitchen environment is just a completely different level. And so it's physically really tiring, but it's also mentally really tiring. And I don't know if you've ever done anything where you kind of knew that you weren't going to enjoy it going in, but it's going to be really good for you. Would you just kind of have to keep repeating to yourself like a daily mantra? But that's kind of hard to overcome, like going into something. I mean, it's not a great attitude to have, but you know, when you just know that something's not going to suit you for whatever reason. So, but it was an amazing learning experience. I'm really glad that I did it.
That's great. I mean, I guess it's kind of looking at the bigger picture. That's what you're saying, really. It's not exactly, it's not a bad attitude, but it's, you know, not everything's for everyone. But just knowing that that will serve you so much in what you want to eventually do.
Yeah, I think I was really scared about doing Ballymaloe and then losing whatever it was that I'd started. So I just, I wanted to learn as much as I possibly could. And I think also when you decide, like turning my back on law and then deciding to go into food obviously was quite a big decision. I think it's quite stressful at that point. You kind of feel like you need to label it. So it's like, I'm going to be a chef, because it feels too wishy-washy just to say, I want to do something in food. But I remember my dad saying to me, and I think it was actually really good advice, that you can't just sit at home sort of brainstorming, trying to come up with a really great idea. Like, the only way those things happen are just by going out there, saying yes to as many opportunities, just getting as much experience as you can. And then those kind of opportunities arise or present themselves, or you figure out what it is that you want to do. So I think that was really good advice. And that was just what I was trying to do. I was just not worrying too much if I found something I didn't want to do, because that was useful as well. Like, I could kind of cross that off the list and then move on to the next thing.
Definitely. So where did you go after the restaurant?
So after the restaurant, I worked for a catering company, again, because that was just a totally different kind of cooking. And I thought that was more what I could see myself doing, like having my own catering company and doing events. But that's obviously a really different kind of cooking to working in a restaurant. So I'd just never been on that side of it. So it was, that felt like another important sort of string to my bow, I guess, just to see, you think you know how you'd go about doing a canapé party for 150 people, but what does that even look like? And, you know, down to really basic stuff, like, do you make the canapés ahead of time, or like how much is assembled on site and whatever, all those things. And being in charge of the stock room and ordering, you know, in the restaurant, I got to junior sous chef. So I was never important enough to actually place the food orders or to sort of manage the stock. But working for a smaller catering company, at the catering company, I was the head chef. So that was like a really fun experience, because I had all the responsibility and, I was in charge of all of that stuff. And so I learned so much being there. And it was small, but they did really great events. Like, we cooked at Windsor Castle and just did like a whole variety of different size events, I guess. So that was really good. But I was there for 5 months, I think. And after that, I think you get to a point when you're doing that for someone else and you think, actually, I think I'm now ready that I could do that myself. And you kind of figured out your style of food, and working for someone else in food, you never have complete freedom over the creativity, and food is so creative. So I think I remember just getting to a point where I wanted to make the food that I wanted to make, and just to have that creative control.
And so how did you sort of set about getting your own clients to do your catering for yourself?
So that's a good question. I can't, I was thinking about that the other day, and I guess it was loads of nepotism, like my mum just making all of her friends have dinner parties, and I think she had loads of dinner parties. But I was thinking, I mean, I was kind of just making it up as I go along, and I remember cooking for some of my sister's friends, and I remember so vividly this weird feeling of, I felt so, I guess guilty is the word, for charging people for cooking, because I love cooking and I was having the best time, and it felt so strange to then invoice someone for something that, I mean, I'd had a good time. And I think it's just a strange, yeah, value. So I was having fun cooking, but also how do you put a value on yourself when it's just you? And oh my goodness, I got that so wrong at the start. I mean, I think I would come away and I probably would have earned £20 from like 2 days' work, because I just, by the time you paid for all the ingredients and everything, I definitely had loads of those kinds of teething problems at the start. And there are really good agencies that help you with freelance work. So I think I did a mixture of my mum's friends and then also these agencies. And then it's just, I guess with all of these things, it's just word of mouth. You just try to do a really good job each time, and then there's someone there that has something that they need a cook for. And yeah, I think it just snowballed from there.
Cool.
I know exactly what you mean with the undercharging. I think it's just so easy to do, especially if you're enjoying the work. And like you said, you're putting a value on yourself. It's so difficult at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I find it hard even now. It's my least favourite bit. And like I had to message another private chef the other day and just check, like,
yeah,
what are you doing? Like, am I doing this right? Because if you give someone a quote and they say, oh no, it does, even now, like I've been doing it for such a long time, and it does make you doubt yourself. But actually you have to decide what that mark is, and if people don't want to pay, that's absolutely fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's sort of, it's just finding your feet, isn't it? It's just
So you created your own ice cream brand called Nunnan Ice Cream. Can you tell us a bit about where that idea came from and how you kind of began it?
Yeah, so I think it was kind of a continuation of what my dad said about just going with the flow and, you know, trying to go with ideas as and when they came. And so I love being a chef, but I think I guess maybe going back to like the invoicing point, and I found it hard that my food was the product, but I was also the product. Mm-hmm. I found that really difficult. So I think the idea of having a product-based business was really appealing. I'm also completely obsessed with sort of entrepreneur stories and how they got started. And so I just constantly be reading books about how the innocent guys grew innocent into what they did, and all of these different stories. And so I think it felt really natural that I would then try to start my own business. And the ice cream, I mean, I had lots of different ideas, and that was kind of the one that I settled on. And it's so random to think about it now, but basically it was an ice cream made out of frozen bananas. And I think it sort of just tied in so well with what was happening in the food scene at the time. Like, everyone was talking about gluten-free and veganism was just taking off. I mean, obviously it's been around for a really long time, but people were sort of beginning to get really excited about it. And then also the sugar aspect, and there were just so many things. And I think I saw people making a version of this banana ice cream at home, where you literally just blend up frozen bananas and it makes a delicious sort of healthy alternative to ice cream, but also something exciting that you could have for breakfast and it wasn't just a pudding. So I felt like it ticked loads of boxes. And I think I was just so excited to have a different kind of challenge. And yeah, it was really exciting. And I did it, I think it was 2 years.
And no one was doing anything like that at that point.
No, so that was what felt really exciting. Some of my other ideas I don't know if you've ever had this, but you sort of get this idea and then you run to the computer and you Google it and you see if anyone else is doing it. And if one other person is doing it, you're like, oh no, I can't do that because that one person has done it. But I definitely don't think that is right. Like, you can do your own thing in your own way and make it your own. And in some ways, if someone else is doing it, kind of confirmation that there's a market for it and it's a good idea. But you know, it is also exciting to be the first to market. So that was the route that I went down. And actually, I think in many ways that was one of the really hard things, was having to explain the whole concept. Whereas if this category already existed, people just would kind of understand without you having to do the whole spiel. But that was sort of a lot of the uphill battle, was explaining what it was and why it was, which I didn't really anticipate before I started, but that was one of the really hard things. I also think if I could go back in time, I would not choose a frozen product.
I was just going to ask. I mean, the challenge with getting a frozen product to store.
It was really hard. It was really, really hard. And I think that actually made it so much more painful than it had to be. And I think maybe that was sort of what drained lots of my energy. Having to deal with like the frozen logistics, like the transport, or a buyer saying, oh yeah, it sounds great, like we'd love some samples, and then knowing that costs about £150 to get them the samples, and then 9 times out of 10 some doofus doesn't put the samples in the freezer when they get them, and then the buyer says, oh, you know, it's liquid, so you have to do that again, and then suddenly you spent £1,000 and you have nothing to show for it. So yeah, if I could go back in time, I would make potato crisps, I think, and just send 1 million samples out. But those are the things that you just, I mean, maybe other people do consider all of those things, but I think I just got so excited about the idea and being first, and it felt so creative. And the timing felt so right as well.
It definitely was.
Yeah, yeah, but actually, yeah, I didn't really think this was a thing, but I think you can be too early. So Innocence, an interesting one, because there was a company before them that I now can't remember the name of, but that kind of proves my point, is that they were the first. They kind of paved the way in lots of ways, but they were just a bit too early. And I think maybe I was just a bit early.
Yeah. Where were you making the product?
So I think, again, because it was frozen and because of the logistics, I got a manufacturer, which actually wasn't as scary as it sounds. Like, I didn't have to pay him unless he was making, and it was really small batches. And I think actually, I think that is quite good advice, because if you start making it at home, there's still so much equipment that you need to get that you actually, and then, you know, you grow out of that at some point. Then you have to do the manufacturing stage. So I think it is quite good advice to try and think about that early on. So you've kind of got all of your ducks in a row, and maybe it was it being frozen did make that quite a lot more complicated. So that was all outsourced. And you know, it was really good. And we ended up getting stocked in Iceland, and we sold sort of, I can't even remember what the figures are now, but I think it was close to 100,000 units. So we did sell them, and the demand was there, but I think it was just, I would love to have been able to sell it direct through the website. I think that's so exciting when people can do that. Sorry to just sound like a broken record, but it being frozen just meant all of those things were so much more difficult. And I was trying to bootstrap it, so I was just still chefing all the time and just putting everything from my cooking business into the ice cream. And it was just too much for one person. Like, there's a reason all of these companies have like teams and experts. And I was definitely not an expert. I was just making it up as I went along and learning, which I guess is the most important thing. Like, I learned so much from it. And so I think it got to a point where I think I was at the stage where I needed external investment, but actually there had been so many bumps along the way, it causes you to just sit and reflect as to, is it what you really want? Because if you're I was living and breathing it, and it was sort of all consuming. But if you're not loving it, or if there's any doubt in your mind, I think you do get to a point where you need to ask yourself some really honest questions.
Yeah, you have to weigh up the stress. It's not even just financial. It's how it's making you feel.
Yeah.
And how it's affecting your life, yeah. Really.
And I think as well, we're always taught that if you work really, really, really hard and you really believe in something, it will all be okay and you will succeed. And I think that's a really great message, and I wouldn't want to ever take away from that. But that isn't 100% true, because sometimes things aren't meant to happen. You know, maybe you can't really, really believe in something. You can't will something to succeed if the market demand isn't there, or you've got your pricing. There are so many different things that could affect that. And so I think sometimes that can be dangerous, because you could maybe carry something on a lot longer than you should, when actually you just got to be honest. You've got to sit down. You've got to make some really tough decisions and then go from there. And I think that's kind of where I got to. I was talking to investors, and I think we had a really a meeting with a really big stockist, and it was sort of on the cusp of everything changing and it being really exciting. And then that got delayed, and they said that they wanted to stock it, but it would be another 8 months. And that kind of gave me pause for thought to think, I don't know if I have it in me to wait 8 months. And actually, when I made the decision, it felt like a huge weight had been lifted off my shoulders, and I just kind of, I had a spring in my step, and it felt really exciting again, which I think in lots of ways I can kind of look back and think, oh, you know, that's something that I did that didn't work or didn't go the way that I wanted it to. But actually, I think maybe you learn more from stuff that doesn't work out. I think that's what, you know, lots of entrepreneurs say, is you do learn the most from, you know, I think they call them failures, but but I think that's true. Like, if everything just goes your way, I don't know what you actually learn from it, because how much of that was due to happenstance and luck, and how much of it was due to your sort of amazing business. I don't know. So looking back, it's like a really exciting thing that I did. And we did a cookbook as part of it, which was really exciting and really fun. And I think most of all, it felt really creative. And I think that's just the really exciting thing about food, is there. It's so many different avenues you can go down and so many different things that you can do. So it was just an exciting time.
I wish I'd tried it.
Oh. I still have some in there. It was delicious. You can take my word for it.
And you're right, it's just all added to your experience. It's another sort of part of your portfolio, if you like, that you've done as well.
Yeah. I think something that I definitely am really scared of in life is I don't want to ever look back and think, oh, I wish I'd been brave, or I wish I'd tried to do something. I don't want to be a granny and sort of be bitter about people who've done these amazing things because I was too scared. So I would much rather do something that didn't work out than wonder if maybe what could have been. I don't know.
Yeah, and I wouldn't even say that it didn't work out or that it was a failure. It was just something that you tried. I mean, you sold 100,000 units. I'm not sure if that is a failure at all, really. And you decided that it wasn't for you and you didn't want to take it forward. Yeah. I think that's a really difficult decision.
I think it's really brave.
Yeah, especially when you've got that demand and you've got the interest there. And you decided, actually, no, that's not where my passion lies, and that's not something I wish to pursue. And that's brave.
Well, I think that's a much nicer way of framing it. So, yeah, let's go with that.
So let's talk about the podcast.
Okay.
I'm sure a lot of the people listening already listen to Desert Island Dishes, but tell us what the concept is.
So the concept is really simple. It's a different guest every week, and we ask them about their 7 desert island dishes. So they range from the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and then we end with the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
And where did you come up with the idea?
So I guess essentially it's a game that I've been playing my whole life. Like, I have always loved food, and I not only love eating food, obviously love cooking food, but I love talking about food. And yeah, it's just a game that I've always played with my friends and family, particularly the final dish, like, what would your last dish be? And I know there's sort of a version of death row dinners, but that does feel a little bit morbid. So the whole desert island thing just felt a bit more joyful, a bit more celebratory. You know, I think the island's really nice, so they're going to have a good time when they get there. And yeah, I've been thinking about starting a podcast for a while, but it's not something that I have any experience in, so I don't know if you guys felt the same way, but just sort of
Google how to start a podcast.
Yeah, Google is your friend. And yeah, so the idea to start a podcast had been there for a while, and then I think I was just driving along and I thought, oh my goodness, Desert Island Dishes, that would be a good name for a podcast, and I could ask these questions. But I was driving, so I was like, oh, I don't know, maybe someone's already doing that. And so sort of as soon as I could, I pulled over and Googled it, and it wasn't a thing, no one else was doing it, so I quickly trademarked it. And then, yeah, the questions, they just kind of wrote themselves, and then I think it was 2 weeks later that I recorded the first episode, so I didn't hang around.
And how did you go about approaching your first guest? And who was your first guest?
It was Esther Walker, who's Giles Corran's wife. And I'd sort of been following her on Instagram, and she seemed really nice, mm-hmm. which I think is a top tip for anyone starting an interview podcast. Pick someone just really friendly and nice for your first guest. And yeah, she said yes, which was kind of amazing. And yeah, she was so nice and made it very unscary, but I wouldn't want to listen back to those first episodes. Lots of people seem to assume that I am just very well connected, and that could not be further from the truth. I don't know any of the people that I'm interviewing. It's just a case of reaching out and pitching to them, I guess, which maybe that was a good thing that came out of the ice cream, was, you know, that was such a big part of it, was just constantly pitching to buyers and not being upset if you didn't hear anything back, because, you know, 9 times out of 10 you wouldn't. So yeah, just I guess being brave and reaching out to people and hoping that some of them say yes.
So the podcast has been a huge success, and you've had some incredible guests so far, and just had your first ever live show with Madeline Shaw.
Yeah.
When did you start thinking about the possibility of doing live recording?
So I think there are so many things to think about with a podcast that I kind of didn't think about. Maybe it was good that I didn't. I just sort of dove straight in. But interviewing people is a technique, and it's one of those things that you can only practice by doing it. But maybe I could have interviewed some of my friends and done a bit more preparation that way. But I definitely think that it's been a process, it's been an evolution over the last like year and a half. And I listen to a lot of podcasts. I love podcasts, and all the ones that I listen to do live shows, and I've been to lots of live shows, and it's so fun. It's really fun. It's fun putting faces to names and seeing how it all happens. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's fun. And so I did think before Christmas, I thought, okay, 2019, I think I'm going to start doing some live shows. And, you know, Madeline, I'd been wanting to get her on the podcast for ages, so she seemed like a great first guest. But what I didn't, it's sort of very easy just to say that. And then as the time approaches, I got more and more nervous. And yeah, I haven't really done much public speaking. I was in plays at school, and my dad was always trying to make me join the debating team, and I was always fighting him and never wanted to do anything like that. So it all seemed like a very good idea until about 10 minutes before, which is, I thought I was going to pass out. But no one heckled me. I don't think podcast audiences are really like that. And it was, it ended up being, it being so fun. I was really glad that I felt very confident in the sort of interviewing aspect because I've done so many now. I think Madeline this week was number 75. So that's 75 interviews.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
That's incredible.
It's crazy. That's so many. Yeah. And so that was a real comfort that bit wasn't scaring me. It was just like the introduction where, I don't know, have you guys watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel?
Yes, love
the
it.
Best program
so
ever.
Good.
So I was just trying to channel my inner Mrs. Maisel and make everyone laugh, which obviously I'm like nowhere near as funny as she is. But yeah, it was way more fun than I thought it was going to be. And now that I survived and I didn't pass out, I think we can plan some other ones.
And did you have help with the production and sort of managing the venue as well?
Yeah, the sound was amazing.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, I was a bit worried about the sound aspect because that I was in charge of that, which is never a good idea because I don't really know what I'm doing. But as with all of these things, we just went for it and it worked out. But so I have a manager and she's amazing and she helped with the venue and all of that side of things. But the venue was really great because they do really delicious brunches. So it was a really gorgeous room, sort of like the rooftop room. And I think there were 55 people in the end. So it was like, that felt like a lot of people to me, but it wasn't, you know, 1,000. And yeah, everyone had brunch and it was on a Saturday as well. So it just felt like quite a nice thing to do for the weekend. Yeah, I'm really lucky having help with it. But also I love like the event production side of things. Mm-hmm. I think because of being a chef and doing all of that side of things, I kind of enjoy that aspect.
Yeah.
The selling tickets thing. It didn't. That was kind of stressful.
I think that's the worst part of any event.
Yeah, like, really is anyone going to come?
Yeah. That, and because people are so last minute, we talked about this with Mira, people like to book in the last week or they're waiting for their friends to get back to them. And then you're on the other end. Like, is anyone going to book a ticket?
Like, seriously, is anyone coming? and luckily they did and it was all fine. But yeah, lots of messages too saying, I am coming, but I'm waiting for payday. Like,
yeah.
Hurry up, payday. but yeah, that was really fun. And so now I do hope that we can do some more.
From the podcast, you've kind of created lots of extras on top, if you like. So your supermarket snoop and your fridge foragers, which are really fun. So did these just feel like a natural extension of your podcast?
Yeah, they felt like a really natural extension. And I guess in some ways it's really hard. There are so many people out there doing amazing things with food. So it's kind of hard to carve your own path and figure out exactly what your sort of area is going to be. And I think particularly on social media, there, you know, what you're putting out to the world is in lots of ways your brand. Like it's your own personality. And I think I definitely learned that from the live event. It felt way less scary that I just had to be myself, whereas I think if you've been pretending to be something that you're not, that would be quite intimidating, because I mean for me I would just forget what who I was or what I was doing. So that felt really nice, and was definitely showing, I think just the old adage of being yourself is true, and that's important with social media. And I think through the podcast, in a funny way, it's kind of shown me how much I love food and sort of the bits that are particularly interesting to me. So I'm really interested in the food that we're all eating every day. And I love spending hours in the kitchen and cooking amazing like slow roasts and all of these things for clients. But I think maybe my most useful purpose is is showing people that lots of food that they think is complicated is actually much simpler. And I think, so yeah, I started this thing on Instagram called Supermarket Snoop, which makes me sound crazy, but I go up to a stranger in the supermarket and talk to them about what they're buying. And I think it's so interesting because it links in with the podcast in the way that it's so rarely just about the food. So on the podcast, I ask people to tell me the best dish they've ever eaten. And of course, there have been some like unbelievably delicious sounding dishes, but it's about so much more than that. It's about who you're with and what the occasion was. And, you know, maybe it's a piece of toast that you had after you've given birth. And it's the occasion. And it's kind of the same when you start speaking to strangers in the supermarket. Obviously, food is the starting point and it's, you know, good conversation starter. But actually, people really open up to you and you find out so much more than just what they're buying. And I think that's what's so interesting to me. And it's really fun. Obviously, it's amazing meeting some of the guests that I've met on the podcast and finding out how they've got to where they are, and they're such interesting people. But like everyday people that you meet in the supermarket, their stories are just as interesting. Mm. And so it's kind of fun to be able to tell those stories through a different medium. And the fridge foraging, yeah, I guess that's just the way that I love cooking. It's sort of being really creative with what you've got and not being fancy or sort of snotty about it, which I think the podcast has kind of helped me to rediscover what I'm passionate about when it comes to food, and that feels exciting.
I think you are providing accessibility to food. I think there's so many amazing cookbooks that you can buy, but you're right. Often you have to sort of buy all the ingredients ready so you have that in. You may not necessarily have everything in for a specific recipe. So you need those tools or those tips to hand in mind. You can say, oh yeah, I saw that on Margie, and I can just mix that with that and just bish, bash, bosh, get it done in 30 minutes.
I think so much of why people don't cook as much as maybe they could do is because it's just fear of the unknown, and you're scared of something going wrong and if it's not perfect. But that food isn't meant to be like that. It's meant to be fun and it's meant to be creative, and it's something that you can only get better at by practicing. And so yeah, I think if I can help to sort of make it seem less serious, and I think like my personality is like I'm not like a super serious person, so if I can try and make it seem fun and accessible. And I think also, like I've been a chef now for 10 years, like that's quite a long time, and that's a lot of cooking experience, and anything that, you know, could potentially go wrong in the kitchen, that probably has happened to me, and yet everything has been fine. Like, you know, it all works out. And so I think, yeah, there's so many people in the world doing these amazing things with food, but I think sort of reminding myself that I am actually a chef. Like, I don't just love food, it's my career, it's my job, it's what people pay me to do. So it feels fun to then be able to share that kind of for free, I guess, on the website and on social media. And yeah, it's so fun. And making people, I don't know, lots of the comments about the podcast are sort of getting people excited about food again, and that feels really fun.
It is. I mean, I think your message across the podcast with the Desert Island Dishes and the Snoop and the Fridge Forage, it's really important. And it's kind of, I mean, with the Fridge Forage, it's also kind of, I feel like, helping people not to be so wasteful by actually looking at what they've got, and that's kind of quite a prevalent message at the moment. And it also reminds me of Ready Steady Cook, which I love, and so I'm always like, oh, what's she gonna make out of her five things?
Yes, Ready Steady Cook was just the best program ever, and I think it was so clever for that reason. It was sort of showing you that you can make amazing things out of really not much. And the sort of moldy looking vegetables in the back of your fridge, they can be turned into something amazing. And I think that's part, like, cooking is, and I've just said it, but cooking is meant to be fun. So if you can sort of remind yourself of that, and I don't know, yeah, turning it into a game and making it something like that, I think that's only a good thing.
Yeah, and it's very accessible, and it's very, you know, like the questions you're asking on the podcast, they're kind of questions we all, as you say, you've done it forever with friends and family, we all ask those questions. And so it's just very unifying. And I feel like, you know, there are a lot of amazing chefs doing amazing things, but some of it's not that accessible.
Yeah.
And so it's really nice. It feels very universal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think it's, yeah, you learn stuff about the guests that you wouldn't learn from a different kind of interview. Like, it's weirdly revealing, even though it's sort of based around food, you do get an insight into their family and their closest friends, and they'll tell you anecdotes that you maybe wouldn't get in a different kind of interview. And I really like the sort of juxtaposition of having a Michelin-starred chef who's cooking this, like, you know, incredible food, but then what are they actually coming home and eating? Like, that's a really interesting thing. Like, obviously, they're professional food is amazing and interesting in a different way, but I want to know what they actually, you know, what do they eat when they're needing something comforting, or what do they turn to on a Sunday night? I think that's where we can learn the most. And yeah, it's the same with the supermarket snoop. Like, these people that I'm talking to aren't, you know, particular foodies, but I think from everyone that I've spoken to, they've given me something where, you know, it's a different ingredient or a tip about some kind of cooking. And I think that's really interesting, and I don't want all of those tips to just be lost, so it's kind of fun to be able to actually write them down and tell other people about them.
Do you think you'll take the podcast in other avenues? Because I could see it as a magazine column.
That's a good idea.
I could see it in, like, yeah, more live shows, and I can, you know, picture you at, like, festivals interviewing. What are you thinking? Or
yeah,
where do you take it?
I think all of those things. I think, yeah, I think that's nice of you to say. I can see all of those things too.
a book as well would be cool.
A book would be amazing, definitely.
Yeah, that would be really fun.
With, like, recipes, interviews, portraits.
Yeah, that would be really fun.
Any publishers listening?
Anyone out there? yeah, all of those things. And I think I'm the kind of personality where I can really easily think, oh, I want to do this, 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 and this. And so I kind of have to put my own brake on sometimes and just make sure that I'm doing what I'm currently doing in the best way that I can. And then I think if you do that, then those other opportunities kind of come as they're meant to. Mm-hmm. I don't want to commit to doing all of these other things and then lose my core sort of thing that I'm doing.
Yeah, you want to do what you're currently doing really well, yeah, and then just add on.
Yeah,
gradually.
But yes, definitely going to start doing more live shows, and all of those things you mentioned are being talked about. So yeah. it feels really exciting that there's lots of different directions that it can go.
It's very cool to see what you're doing from the podcast, because podcasting's, you know, a fairly new medium at the moment still, and there are, you know, big name magazines or companies who have a podcast on the side from that, but you're kind of doing it the other way,
yeah,
and creating
true.
A brand and a business from a podcast. And it's not really something that many people are doing yet. You know, it feels like a new avenue that you're taking.
Other than you guys. But no, you're right. In I know what you mean. Lots of magazines have a podcast, and then lots of big name celebrities start a podcast. But yeah, without being either of those things, it has been interesting just sort of, but I guess building it from the ground up and just seeing what happens. But I think that's what's exciting, isn't it? Doing something without any expectations. Mm-hmm. And that's, I guess, goes back to why it's so important to do something that you love and that you're really passionate about, because unlike the ice cream, this is definitely something that, you know, I could see just being my life, like, day in, day out. I don't think I would ever get bored of it.
Yeah.
So yeah, that feels exciting.
Yeah, it is.
And are you still chefing as well?
Yeah, I'm still chefing. Yes.
Private chef.
Yeah, private chefing for all sorts of different events. So yeah, it's a juggling act. But at least it's all in the same area, like in, you know, it's all food focused. But yeah, it's definitely, I guess with private chefing, it's sporadic. So it's hard to get into a routine because every week is completely different depending on what events you've got going on and when you can interview people. So that if there was to be one bit that I'm finding slightly difficult at the moment, it is that aspect.
So you have to fit everything that you need to do, editing and well everything else around your interviews and your private chef jobs.
Yeah, and we've only just started taking sponsors on the podcast, so obviously the priority has been my cooking jobs because that is how I earn a living, but maybe that's going to now start shifting and become a bit more balanced, so yeah, hopefully that's going to be exciting too.
And so that kind of leads us on to asking about your typical week, which you probably don't have, but do you structure, you know, do you have things that you make sure you do at a certain time and things that you always do every week?
So I guess because I don't really have a structure and because every week is so different, I think maybe that's what I've tried to do a little bit with my Instagram, is to create a bit of structure in there. So the podcast comes out every Thursday, then every Friday I do my supermarket snoop, every Monday I do a fridge forage. And I think maybe not consciously, but maybe subconsciously, that's just been me trying to get some kind of order in my life. And that's nice to have that kind of routine. The supermarket snoop comes out every Friday morning, and pretty much without fail, you'll find me on a Thursday night walking around the supermarket trying to find someone to snoop on. So yeah, I always seem to leave that to the last minute. But but yeah, it's nice to have. I don't think I would work that well with a super rigid structure, but equally it just turns into chaos if you don't have any semblance of order in your life. So yeah, that feels like a nice balance at the moment.
Yeah.
Do you have any strategies for staying well, maintaining your well-being during the week while you've got so many things to manage and balance?
That is a very good question. I don't know if this is like a great strategy, but I'm like a big list maker. Mm-hmm. So I think having things going on in your head can be very stressful. So the moment you get it down on paper, you can stop worrying about it. I'm trying really hard at the moment to be on my phone less, and I don't think I'm doing that that well at it. But in the evenings, I'm trying to sort of separate myself from my phone because I just think that's so unhealthy. I think daily having a dog is it's really good because that does give you like a semblance of routine and structure, and having to get outside and take him to the park and going for a walk, I think that's a really important part of my day and part of my week. But yeah, I think in all of those areas I could probably do way better. but yeah, you probably have a lot to learn in that front.
There's only so much you can do, and you have to put in place what.
I think also when you're working for yourself, you know, you've got to put in the time and you've got to make stuff happen because no one else is going to. So even if there are stressful times and sort of sometimes it feels a bit overwhelming, I think knowing that maybe that stage isn't going to last forever, and just knowing that you just have to try your hardest, again going back to not wanting to look back and think, oh, I wish I'd tried harder, I wish I'd done this differently. So but yeah, knowing that that is probably just a stage, is reassuring, I think.
So finally, what do you feel is your greatest achievement within your career?
Oh my goodness, that is such a good question. Not because I'm like, oh, I've got so many. More just, I don't think I'm sort of very good at reflecting and thinking like that. But maybe my greatest achievement is being brave and deciding not to be a lawyer. Because that did feel like quite a big deal, and I felt like there was quite a lot of expectation on me, having been to Oxford, it did feel like a bit of a curveball to tell everyone that I was going to retrain as a chef. And so I think maybe it would have been easier. And I do sometimes think, like, oh, yes, no, I could be maybe high up in a law firm with a really nice oak desk and life would look different. But I think it's important to be brave and to do what you're passionate about. And so maybe that's what I would call my greatest achievement.
I think that's a good one.
Yeah. Where can people find you and listen to the podcast?
So you can find the podcast where I think all places that podcast is streaming. Yeah. And Desert Island Dishes. And then I have a website, desertislanddishes.co. And on Instagram, I'm just Margie Nomura. So, yeah.
Great. Thank you, Margie.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Thanks so much for listening. You can find us on Instagram at What's Cooking Podcast, on Twitter at What's Cooking Pod, or drop us an email, thewhatscookingpodcast@gmail.com.
If you liked this episode, be sure to subscribe and leave us 5 stars.